From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author Jacob Guanzan, whose new book is Abundance, published by Grey Wolf Press. Jacob was born in Manhasset, New York, and then raised in Minnesota. He holds a degree in sociology from Hamline University and a Master of Fine Arts from Columbia University. He lived in Madrid for several years, where he began teaching, translating, and publishing prose. In 2015, he moved from Spain to New York City, where he continues to live and work. Here's a little information about Abundance. Evicted from their trailer on New Year's Eve, Henry and his son Junior have been reduced to living out of a pickup truck. 6 months later, things are even more desperate. Henry, barely a year out of prison for pushing opioids, is down to his last pocketful of dollars, and little remains between him and the street. But hope is on the horizon. Today is Junior's birthday, and Henry has a job interview tomorrow. To celebrate, Henry treats Junior to dinner at McDonald's, followed by a night in a real bed at a discount motel. For a moment, as Junior watches TV and Henry practices for his interview in the bathtub, all seems well. But after Henry has a disastrous altercation in the parking lot, and Junior succumbs to a fever, father and son are sent into the night, struggling to hold things together and make it through tomorrow. Jacob Guanzan organizes Abundance by the amount of cash in Henry's pocket. A new chapter starts with each debit and credit, and the novel expands and contracts, revealing the extent to which the quality of our attention is altered by the abundance, or lack thereof, that surrounds us. Set in an America of big-box stores and fast food, the novel trawls the fluorescent aisles of Walmart and the booths of Red Lobster to reveal the inequities and anxieties around work, debt, addiction, incarceration, and health care in America today. The New York Times Book Review has said, "What Abundance captures is how mundane poverty is and how psychologically punishing." Our interview begins with my first question for Jacob. I hope you enjoy our conversation. You know, I hate to be so unoriginal, but because everybody talks about this, but I was so taken by your chapter headings, and I thought, why don't we start there? Because it is like one of the first things you see when you open the book, and it's so original. Heading the chapters with the amount of money that's literally in Henry's pocket at any given moment. How did you come to that, and when did you have that idea? You must have been like, aha!
Well, I'm happy to talk about it because it's an idea that I still get really excited about. Yeah. Because I think it really frames the experience of not of both poverty and Henry's circumstance, the protagonist of the novel, but anybody who's living under financial hardship. And you know, right now during the pandemic, 63% of this country is living paycheck to paycheck. So when you're living under these kinds of financial constraints, the kind of ever presence of your budget and spending power is right there at the forefront of your consciousness. And I think that's what I really wanted to do with labeling the chapter headings as the amount of cash that Henry had in his pocket, to really put that right there in the reader's mind from the beginning of each chapter at where he's at, and then within the text of the narrative itself, really show how these expenditures and even minor gains ultimately dictate his trajectory in the story, as it does in so many people's lives.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, right away, you know, like the book opens and he's got $89.34. And then at some point in that chapter, he finds a quarter. And of course, the next chapter is $89.59. And I was like, oh my God, I mean, it really brings home just how much he needs money to survive, and how important every little bit of it is. And You know, there are other moments in the book that bring this home for us. You know, it's always kind of an ever-present part of the narrative. So like every measurement concerns money. Everything that happens to him has a resource reflection, right? So he traveled a gallon east, and his index finger slides coin after coin across a counter, and he counts out 4 pennies and 7 nickels. And then the other thing that happens, and I just thought this was a wonderful detail, he's constantly grazing the outline of the cash that's in his front pocket. It's become sort of almost like a tick or a gesture of his. These are all ways in which you really bring home and keep in our minds as readers the severity of his situation.
I really appreciate that kind of attentiveness to those more subtle cues that a writer is going to employ, especially the pocket check, right? That was one that I really wanted to kind of incorporate throughout the book. Just as these little cues and, yeah, like you said, ticks that really remind the reader of how frequently Henry is, you know, kind of checking, you know, where, reassessing where he's at and reminding himself where he's at. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, one of the first instances he does that is actually when he gets his first paycheck as a teenager.
Right.
And so that was, you know, just the gesture of kind of physically where his front pocket is located is almost like a slight innuendo as well, because so much of, you know, toxic masculinity is one of the really present themes that I wanted to kind of wrestle with in this book as well, and how that's really this notion of a man's worth, it mm-hmm. comes down to his dollar spending. And so that kind of location on him is almost a nod to this notion of himself, of him measuring himself up by the money that he has in his pocket. And
wow.
So that's just like one of the kind of cues that I was trying to, you know, implement throughout, just to really not only just cue the reader, but kind of to explore all of the ways that money is going to inform a character's, or just an individual's, really, sense of self-worth, in this society, not only their spending power, which, I mean, the two become so inextricably linked in a culture like ours.
Yeah, that's amazing. I did notice, of course, the gesture I just mentioned where he's, you know, feeling the outline of the cash in his pocket, but I didn't think about the proximity there and the indication of his youthful tie into his masculinity. And that's really interesting. No, it's great. Thanks for pointing that out. Now the setting, correct me if I'm wrong, this setting is a little bit universal, like it is, I think in the description on the book cover, it says it's set in the fluorescent aisles of Walmart and the booths of Red Lobster, but it's not set in a certain place. Is that correct?
Yeah, I got sidetracked with your initial question, because I didn't really speak so much to the kind of genesis of the book itself.
Oh, sure,
and I think if I frame it that way, it might make a little bit more sense, because, you know, I wrote this book right after completing my MFA at Columbia. And I've been in New York since. So I've been here about 6 years now. And I had studied sociology in undergrad. And so I've always been really concerned and fascinated and really terrified by notions of class. And that's really informed a lot of my fiction. But then also, you know, really finding a space to unpack the notion of money was really important to me at this time. Mm-hmm. And there was one particular moment where this is the experience I need to write about, because I was at a grocery store. I live up in Harlem, but I was down on the Upper West Side at, it's a wealthier, whiter area.
Right.
And I was at a grocery store there, and, you know, the line was being held up, and I could feel, you know, that those huffs of indignance, you know, just the way the people behind me felt so inconvenienced by being, you know, delayed in their commercial experience, you know, their rights were being infringed upon, right? Yeah. And I took I was next in line, and so I took a peek, you know, what the holdup was, and there was a woman who was doing exactly as Henry did in the McDonald's, who was sliding her coins. She was at the bagging station just trying to reach the sum of her total through with coins, and I found it really striking because it really would not have taken anybody else behind me much, you know, it wouldn't have been difficult to just crane their necks, and I'm sure quite a few did see who was holding the lineup, and that they remained so, like I said, indignant and just insensitive to this experience, because nobody's paying with change, you know, unless they have to these days, right? I mean, and so that kind of, that rift, that just utter lack of, you know, a moment's empathy, I found really striking and tragic and compelling. And I was like, this is something I have to do, just work on a little bit. And that's where the idea of organizing it, at first a short story in this kind of framework, came from. So, yeah. And now I backpedaled a little bit, and now where was I going with this?
Well, actually, before you go, we were going to talk about setting, but before we go there, I just want to mention that what you've just said reminded me of a line that I was so taken with, and I'm not going to read the whole paragraph, but it ends up with Henry wondering if he will fall into the ranks of the jaded herd of the wealthier people, all of them shuffling after the only thing left, more, which was just such an extraordinary line. And it makes me think literally of the people that you're talking about standing behind you in the grocery store. They're so jaded, they can't even find the empathy to allow this woman a minute. You know, that's, anyway, so I think we were talking about setting too.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very flattered that you like that line. And I like that one too.
It's at the tail end of an absolutely beautiful paragraph. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Like I was saying, so that experience and just the genesis of the story did occur here in New York. But as I thought about, you know, how I'm going to kind of populate this budgeting framework in terms of organizing a story and who I wanted to insert within this framework and the kind of landscape I thought would make sense. Well, New York wasn't that for me. I'm a visitor here. You know, I'm no New Yorker. I don't ever feel like I will be. There's lots to love and appreciate about this town. I do enjoy it, but I really wanted to go back to my roots for this story, and I thought there was a lot more to mine in terms of not only familiar personal experiences, but really just to take a lot of the textures of experience that I could draw from my upbringing in Minnesota. But I didn't quite want to pinpoint, you know, the specific town that I had grown up in right outside of the Twin Cities or even Minneapolis, where my parents split up and grew up in, you know, very working class neighborhood of South Minneapolis. And I was a bit wary of specifying, you know, the places that I grew up as, not really because I was reticent about divulging too much of my personal experience, but just because I anytime I left New York and drove around the East Coast and everywhere else in between the kind of metropolitan areas of the states are so homogenous in a lot of ways, and it felt really important to me that this felt like an American story, where there's something almost not unique about it.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want it to feel as if this was some sort of aberration from the status quo, because it is a drastic Henry situation. There is a lot of it's a quite dire situation, but I wanted that landscape to feel similar to lots of readers, to as many readers as possible. Anybody who stepped outside of a city larger than 500,000 people, you know, it's like these are the landscapes that we all know once we're passing on the freeway, right?
Right. You know, it's interesting because we've all noticed that America has become more homogenous in look. You know, like we all have the same strip malls now and the same big box stores. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I've ever put it together as well as you've just described about what the implications are about that for individual wealth or lack thereof, you know, and what's been happening to America while the look of America has changed from very unique from place to place to being all rather homogenous. That's really interesting.
Yeah. I don't think I necessarily have the answer. And I suppose that's why I write fiction, because I don't think I'd ever want to posit that I've thoroughly analyzed this with a cause and effect kind of explanation. But it's certainly, you know, these kinds of observations that I like to that fascinate me, and I want to kind of just pose as questions, because I think it really is interesting, especially the facade of retail homogeneity and the sterility of these very familiar franchises, that there's no variation in terms of the aesthetics of these places, right? There, and when you go in, the layout is completely familiar. It's really the individual people that are going to be the source of anything that's unique about these places, right? And so that, I think, honing in on just a single character is really the only access point of kind of getting a flavor for the universal. You know, that's one of the great ironies of writing fiction.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about the story itself. So we have Henry and Junior, and Junior is his son, and then Michelle is Junior's mother, but she's missing. There's a backstory that we are promised early on in the novel, but we don't know exactly what's happened. And I'm also not going to spoil anything, but Junior's not feeling well, and that becomes clear really pretty early in the narrative. And of course, when we're talking about poverty and not feeling well, we're thinking healthcare, and it's a very potent part of the storyline that Junior is not feeling well, and it seems like this could be potentially pretty serious the way he's describing the discomfort in his gut. And you know, it's also, we learn as the story goes on that there's kind of like a mirror to this backstory of Henry's mother's illness. Henry's mother had cancer. Her illness really started his father down a very similar path of, becoming poor because of healthcare costs. So I wonder if you want to just talk a little bit about that aspect. And you know, did you have to do a lot of research into healthcare, or was this mostly just what you're familiar with through reading the news every day, sadly?
Sadly, it was largely just a familiarity with what's going on in the world. And you know, I did have to do quite a bit of research about health insurance when it comes to the passing on of debt, because not all states have that. But I had heard a story of a friend of a friend who had inherited debt after losing a parent. Yeah. And I was just astonished by that kind of shameless profiteering off of suffering. I mean, it's bad enough as is with all sorts of other health maladies, right? But after a death, you know, it's just I was just completely floored by that. So I wanted to look a bit more into that. And another point about just, you know, I didn't want to specify with Junior's sickness. I thought it was really important to withhold the specificities of what was happening inside of him, just mm-hmm. to kind of align the reader with the fear that Henry had as to what's going on inside of my boy. You know, I mean, the terror that a parent feels. I mean, when Obama spoke after the Sandy Hook shooting, and spoke about, he said something along the lines of being a parent is to live with your heart outside of you, you know, at all times. So that really struck me. And that kind of constant state of vulnerability of having the most precious aspect of your life completely at the mercy of this really vicious world at times, you know, just stuck with me. And so to know that your child was being threatened from the inside was, I couldn't imagine a more horrible experience. And because you don't know what exactly is going on, and to compound that horror is the notion that the means are available to diagnose and heal and cure, but that's not an option for somebody in Henry's position. And so that was that, withholding that particular diagnosis in Junior's case was really important to me, to the story, I believe, just to, like I said, align the reader with the terror of Henry's own mystery.
There's an interesting thing that you do there, and this actually brings us into another question. At the end of a chapter where we are learning more about Junior not feeling well, you then transition into the next chapter, and I believe the first sentence of that paragraph, first paragraph, was the wheelchair was overkill. And so at first we think, okay, Henry has brought Junior to the hospital. He's going to bite the bullet and see if he can afford this. And then it becomes clear that we're in a past scene. And you do go back and forth between a sort of present day and a past. And I thought that was a really interesting transition, even though it's a pattern we're used to about going back and forth in time. That sentence, the wheelchair was overkill, made me think we were still with Henry and Junior, but it turns out that we're with Henry in a past moment when he actually was put in a wheelchair. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit just craft-wise about transitions and transitioning between chapters, but also scenes. Is there anything that you might want to say about that?
I have so much fun writing transitions, and it's something as a reader that I'm really attentive to myself, and kind of, you know, just seeing how writers can make these kind of really wild pivots, but also make these transitions as seamless as possible, even though we're leaping through time within a story, mm-hmm. as well as really drastic moods. And I find that so fascinating to when a writer does the same to me, is just like, you know, just completely transports me and makes a really graceful landing into a totally new territory. And so with that example in particular, I really like finding those access points that feel like there's some sort of segue in the subject matter or even tonality of what had preceded it, but then, you know, with more subtle cues of just the shift into the past tense with that particular transition into chapter 00, and that also that chapter heading if a more attentive reader is really going to notice, like, we were just at $89 some. What's going on?
Right.
And so, and then, you know, as you read on, there's a couple more deliberate clues. You know, it's like, oh, he's 16 years old now. It was explicitly stated in the second or third sentence. And that's, you know, you also have to be mindful as a writer as to how, you know, as to kind of guide a reader who's might not be paying as close of attention, because especially for faster readers, you know, just to make sure you are anchoring everybody into that. But so it's a real delicate balance. You
right.
know, you have to be, you really do have to kind of weigh the each beat of these transitions. But I also really love the kind of jarring statements, that those first sentences, the wheelchair was overkill, is one of them. And I'm so glad you pointed that one out, because, you know, it's just a strange sentence that could make sense for what had preceded it. Yet within two or three sentences, we're at a new place, and it piques interest and intrigue and eases into a whole other story that's going to really illuminate on Henry's story.
And it is actually, that is our first jump back in time, isn't it? I'm realizing that now. I think I had kind of let go of that as I was preparing my questions. But that is our first leap back in time, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. So I do want to talk about the theme. In the book, there's a theme of addiction. This is another, of course, theme that comes along with poverty. And this is where he meets Michelle. So the situation where he is in a wheelchair is actually at a rehab center in his past. So he had his own addiction, and Michelle had a different addiction. And I just wonder if you want to talk a little bit about writing about that subject.
Well, with addiction, I thought it was really important to kind of to dwell in the experience, not only because a lot of the addiction and drug abuse here in abundance centers on the opioid pandemic. But again, these kinds of news stories that we're familiar with really become so abstract when they're relayed through a journalistic lens. Like we don't get access to the real kind of humanity that's happening when we discuss addiction and poverty and healthcare problems, every social issue. It's just, there's just so much more removed that, and fiction is such a phenomenal bridge to the more intimate kind of experience of these social issues that we're seeing on a regular basis. And so I thought it was really important to delve into the topic of addiction, just because it's so commonly, you know, cited as a reason for poverty, and that's it, you know.
Right.
But addiction is not, it's not the end all be all of poverty. You know, it's these conditions are so the result of such systematic forces, the interplay of all these various elements but it did seem important to put human faces and experiences with addiction. And I also wanted to conflate, you know, Henry's drug abuse is happening a lot more as a teenager than as an adult. He's a bit more recreational in his usage later on, but he seems to have a handle on it.
Right.
But I really wanted to, with his relationship with Michelle, use addiction as a sort of foil to love to conflate the idea of addiction with that of love or infatuation, and really kind of explore the unhealthy ways we fall in love and treat the people that we care most about, or at least think we care most about. And we really see how toxic how enraptured he is with Michelle really begins to fester into jealousy and distrust and all of these things that, you know, could very well be behind a lot of the reasons she begins to use herself.
Yeah, right. Talking about their relationship, I loved, so at the beginning, as you are describing them, they're so young, and, you know, he's so earnest and kind as a young man, and he says something about her sense of humor, you know, being something, you know, despite her circumstances, she's got this amazing sense of humor that he's attracted her in all kinds of ways. But her personality next to his sort of earnest demeanor, and he had such desire and hope, you know, there was a really interesting combination of forces right from the start. And I wonder if you want to just talk about creating their characters and their relationship, which I won't go to that cliche that it's almost a character in itself, but their relationship is interesting.
Yeah, well, thank you. I really did want to have... I don't want to rely on the opposites attract cliche, but I did I could see Henry, you know, with his earnestness and sincerity that's really at his core, be fascinated. But there's also a great deal of kind of scorn that comes from his awareness, the way he sees the world, right?
Right.
And but that earnest component of him does a lot of work to subdue that. And you see the way he, you know, not only does he do all sorts of cost-benefit analyses with, you know, his financial budgeting, but also with his emotional budgeting. Whereas a character like Michelle is really open with her hostility. And I think there's a great draw to that kind of that reckless expression of hostility that a character like Henry is really going to admire and fall for. And it can be problematic and toxic in certain ways, but there's a lot to be said about that kind of openness that Michelle has, that absolute lack of filter, which a character like Henry is just going to be an absolute sucker for,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Let's see. I always like to ask my guests if they've read anything lately that they might recommend to listeners, all of whom, of course, are readers. Do you have any that you would recommend?
Oh, boy. Let me think. Well, right now, I'm only halfway through a book that that Grey Wolf actually put out, because we're going to be doing I'm just going to be popping in for this little event that they're doing for a book that's being released alongside mine, but it's called The Twilight Zone by Nona Fernandez.
Uh-huh.
Nona Fernandez is a Chilean author. And she wrote Space Invaders that Grey Wolf also put out, I think, 2 years ago. And this new one is, I'm just utterly enraptured by it, because we're talking about transitions, right? This is this book that really spirals through both memory and perspective in such a fascinating way, because it's centered on a protagonist. I believe she's a journalist, but I'm not quite sure what her actual profession is, but she's writing from the present and reflecting on a soldier, or kind of a police, you know, Gestapo type of the Pinochet regime, who approached the press in 1984, I believe it was 1984, and went into an office and said, I'm the man who tortured people, and I tortured people, and goes in to discuss all of the details behind, you know, these atrocities that he was assigned to commit.
In the stadiums, is that... I remember in Chile, Pinochet used to round people up into stadiums.
Yeah, we haven't gotten to any scenes like that. And like I said, I'm only halfway through. But I mean, the kind of these staged accusations, like there was one, she's kind of unpacking this scene where the second in command of the Communist Party of Chile and he, you know, she's reading these various reports and trying to put herself in this character's shoes, and that's what I find so fascinating from a craft perspective, mm-hmm. is how she's very open about the hypothetical reflections and explicitly acknowledging I imagine he felt this, and there's this this acknowledgement of her own uncertainty as a narrator, but at the same time, it's right alongside these really visceral, terrifying depictions of him riding a bus with his school children and a woman in the middle of the bus ride saying, "Someone stole my purse," and then these three police in normal clothes accuse him, drag him off, and he's never seen again.
Oh,
right?
Right.
And I'm getting carried away because I'm just blown away. I've been blown away by this book because it's such a different technique than the kind of stuff that I do in my own writing. And again, it's that kind of artistry in playing with ironic distance from a narratorial perspective is fascinates me.
Right. And it's such an interesting... It's an interesting way to offer somebody else's viewpoint when you're in a first-person description to be able to say, "I imagine he felt this." Is that part of it too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really cool. It's really cool stuff. So.
Now, now, Jacob, what are you working on next?
I have made the mistake of writing another novel. Abundance. I told myself, before writing Abundance, I imagined Abundance as a short story as well. I never thought I had the chops to take on something of that scope. And what I, about the time that Grey Wolf acquired the rights to Abundance, I was tinkering with this, with the ideas of like, it'll be a little novella or something. And it has just blown up into this three-part series. It's kind of like three novellas in one where I have not tried to describe this in a public setting, but I'll just do so. Let me try and do so as concisely as possible because,
you can practice your elevator speech right now.
Thank you so much. Thank you for indulging me. But yeah, this one is, with Abundance, naturally, there's all sorts of politics, simmering under it, in the subtext of the novel. But I really did my best to, restrain myself from any being too didactic or sanctimonious with where my politics are. And I do really recognize that some of my knee-jerk reactions to the state of the world are just as kind of uninformed as somebody on the opposite end of the spectrum. And so I really wanted to kind of, subvert and unpack where I'm at politically and learn more about myself. And so this is kind of a book like, the first character... They're not necessarily characters that cover all areas of a political spectrum, but certain areas that are ostensibly diametrically opposed.
Okay.
But not necessarily. If you were to sketch them out on a kind of Cartesian plane of political ideologies, they wouldn't be exact opposites, but they were certainly the ones I'd like to hone in on. And so the first character is kind of a leftist radical who's plotting some, more destructive acts of revolution because he's dissatisfied with the inadequacy or of civil disobedience, and what that's failed to yield after decades of kind of modeling themselves after Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., et cetera. And then the middle section is the problems of political moderates, which is a Swedish character and is also a chance for me to explore my Swedish roots, because that's where my mother is from.
I wondered where that K came from in Jacob.
Yeah, it's not just trying to be cool, you know. As hard as I try to be cool on a day-to-day basis, the K, that's from my mother. But and then the last character, the third character, is a philanthropist type, you know, who's a very wealthy character, and he, in contrast to the more radical character, he's able to effect social good and these programs that are, you know, ostensibly helping people, yet they're all motivated by his own ego and, you know, a real flagrant narcissism. And so questioning, you know, whether motives actually actually complicate, you know, the end results.
That's interesting.
So that's what I'm working on, and it's almost there.
That sounds really interesting because, you know, we've seen narcissism at the head of government. You know, no matter which side of the political spectrum you might fall, which side of the fence you fall on, you know, I'm sure most of us can see that that was a detriment. But it's interesting to think about, you know, okay, so what if a different, you know, somebody with different politics were a narcissist at the top? And I'm sure we've seen that too, but that's interesting.
Thank you. I'm having fun with it. So we'll see if we can, you know, polish it into something to share. But in the meantime, it's been fun.
Okay, Jacob, I like to finish these interviews by asking for advice for writers. And in your case, I thought I would ask for advice for putting suspense into novels that are perhaps more subtle than like blockbuster mysteries. Because there's quite a bit, and you mentioned this earlier, there is suspense in this book. You know, you offer us little, you know, crumbs of information about things that are going to come later. So, for example, ever since November, the boy has grown stingy with his eye contact. Well, when I read that, I wanted to know why. What happened in November? And then, let's see, there's suspense around what happened with Michelle, what happened with their relationship, where is she, that sort of thing. So, I wonder if you can talk about building suspense in this kind of novel, which is a more, I would say, literary novel.
Absolutely. It's a really great question because those kinds of cues, like just the mention of a month or, you know, those little flickers of callbacks that are peppered throughout the novel that do build a sense of suspense and sort of foreground what's to come. Those are the little details that are really hard to plan for. And I do think that planning for that, at least in my process, I can't. And it's something that you have to discover throughout the writing process, mm-hmm. And then retroactively kind of insert, you know, really strategically think about the placement of those little clues in the revision process, in the rewriting process. And so the two best pieces of advice that I've ever received for writing that I like to share with people is the first one being, to always remember, especially when you're in the drafting process, is that you are your first reader. And I found that so liberating because, you know, a lot of us, when we sit down to write, have that editorial voice hovering over our shoulder that makes us, anytime we put a sentence down, delete it again,
right?
You know, or rethink the phrasing. And so, especially in the drafting process and writing scenes, you know, you got to have fun with it, you know, and entertain yourself to see what these characters are capable of and where they're going to go.
Yes.
And And so that I found to be extremely, yeah, like I said, liberating. It's really the feeling that that piece of advice gave for me. And then the second one, which I think is really great for the revision process, as somebody told me, the goal isn't to be read, it's to be reread. And I thought that was phenomenal because, I mean, I'm the same kind of reader where when I open the book and I can tell I'm in the hands of somebody who's spent a lot of time refining their craft on a stylistic level, mm-hmm. that is somebody I want to hang out with and I'm going to reread, you know? And I won't say I've reached that level yet, but it's certainly something I strive for on a stylistic level as well. You know, just being really mindful to the sounds of sentences, the imagery that I'm invoking, as well as those kind of strategic placements of those foregrounding details, right, that yeah. can help generate suspense. And so that advice of wanting to be striving to be reread is something that really, you know, motivates me to, you know, be as deliberate as possible about every decision I make on the page.
That's wonderful. That's great advice. Okay. So first of all, you're your first reader, and secondly, strive to be reread. I love that. That's great. Okay, I want to just mention again, the name of the book is Abundance, published by Grey Wolf Press, and my guest today has been Jacob Guanzon. Thank you very much for speaking with me today. It went super fast. I have so many more questions, but oh well.
Oh my God, that did go fast, but well, thank you so much. I had so much fun. You know, it was so nice to just talk at a leisurely pace. You know, this was really, really pleasant.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Jacob Guanzon about his new book, Abundance, published by Grey Wolf Press. You can learn more about his work at his website, Jacob with a K. I'm saying that. It's not part of the website. JacobGuanzon.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by Jacob Guanzon. Think back to the last time you made a purchase for which you had to really budget, negotiate, discuss with a loved one, and so on. Before you begin drafting a scene, list out all the pros and cons that you had weighed before reaching a decision, such as how the purchase stood to improve your life, what else you could have purchased with that money, what emotional or symbolic value it held in your view, how its acquisition could change others' perception of you. Then write a scene that's centered on the decision-making process to buy or not to buy, while incorporating as many of your earlier considerations as possible. Jacob recommends doing this in the third person to give yourself some abstract distance. The goal here is to experiment with ways of charging a sense of drama and urgency into the minutiae of financial decisions, which generally aren't brimming over, as he says, with the sexiest narrative material. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. You know what I'm going to say. I say it every week. We are still in the midst of this pandemic, even though there are more vaccinations available week by week, and more people are getting vaccinated week by week, and that's good news. But we aren't through it yet. Please stay safe, stay distanced, don't meet with people unless it's outside, wear your mask. I hope that you're able to read and to write. Keep in mind that the archives of the show offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work. Try to find the books that have come out, even as book tours are being canceled because of the pandemic. Follow their virtual book tours and Zoom in to listen to them speak at their launches and other events. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV-LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. The sun's been peeking out a little bit. Enjoy it. Stay well and have a great week.